This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaqui on Culture and Race, Part 4. In an attempt to understand Yaqui's ideas about culture and race, his views, we've tracked back to the beginning of his book, Imperium, where he summarizes very nicely his thoughts, and it really lays the groundwork for what we can eventually get to his ideas about horizontal versus vertical race that he discusses much deeper in his book. The last time we identified what he called a crisis, what I would describe as him noticing that Europeans had supposedly lost control of their own civilization. And he attributed that to spiritual division, and specifically to what he called a 19th century outlook, the past, versus the 20th century outlook. And I think this is what he's getting at when he talks about horizontal and vertical race, but let's not get ahead of ourselves there. He talks about the solution to this division, the spiritual division, is unity. The idea of uniting the Western civilization and imperium into an imperium. On page 62, he writes, "But the strength of the organism, even in crisis, is too great for a few intellectuals and their mobs to destroy it, and it goes its way. In the Western civilization, the expansive tendency reached the point where, by 1900, 18/20 of the surface of the earth was controlled politically from Western capitals by Jews. And this development merely brought an aggravation of the crisis, for this power will of the West gradually awakened the slumbering masses of the outer world to political activity." Outer world meaning outside of Europe, non-whites. "Before the inner war of classes had been liquidated, the outer war of races had begun. Annihilation wars and world wars, continuous internal strain in the form of unrelenting class war, which regards outer war merely as a means of increasing its demands." There he's referring, I think, to the oligarchs or the plutocrats waging class war against the other classes. Which regards outer war merely as a means of increasing its demands. "The revolt of the colored races against the Western civilization." These are the forms which this terrible crisis takes in the 20th century. This invokes in my mind the book by Lothrop Stoddard, published in 1920, titled The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. Stoddard had 30 years before Yaqui was writing very perceptively noticed this rising tide of the non-whites, that was going to be the ultimate struggle of the 20th century, was between what he called the major races, or the, I forget the exact term he used, Stoddard used for that. But what he meant was the continental races, the black, white, yellow. Yaqui goes on, "The peak of this long crisis exists now in the period 1950 to 2000, and possibly in these very years will be decided forever the question whether the West is to fulfill its last life phase." This was an issue I raised the last time, that Yaqui describes the Western civilization as if it's an organism, as if it's alive. He anthropomorphizes it to the point of describing it as having life phases. And this, in this, he's following Spengler's example, but it really doesn't make as much sense as seeing the life itself, the people themselves, as having life. And it also doesn't explain what he's upset about, why he sees a crisis. If the civilization goes through life phases, is born and dies, well, if it dies, it dies. Why should he care? As one little grain of sand within it. But he does care. I grant him that. I don't think that he understands his own motives. Or at least I can't see that he understands them. I don't understand them. He doesn't spell them out. The proud civilization, which in 1900, and this part I read the last time, the proud civilization, which in 1900 was master of 18/20 of the Earth's surface, arrived at a point in 1945 after the suicidal Second World War, where it controlled no part whatever of the Earth. World power, for all great questions, was decided in two outer capitals, Washington and Moscow. The smaller questions of provincial administration were left to the nations become colonies of the West. And in power, but in all power questions, the regimes based in Russia and America decided all. He, on this page, mentions 18/20 twice, and it seems odd to me because it's not in it. The fraction is not in its simplest form. 18/20 reduces to 9/10, and what most people would call 9/10 is 90%. So where he's saying 18/20 of the Earth's surface was mastered by the European or the Western civilization, most people would have said 90% of the Earth's surface or 9/10. It makes me think that he's citing somewhere else, someone else who used that fraction, or that there's some significance to it that just goes over my head. I really don't understand why he uses those odd numbers, that odd form for the number. He names here the organism's enemy, you know, beyond just this division, this spiritual division that just happened, that he doesn't really explain how it happened or the mechanism. He does mention that the enemy is few intellectuals and their mobs. He does a little later on, though, in a section I'm not going to bother reading, he mentions the culture distorters and barbarians, the Jews and other non-whites, in other words. But he sees them, obviously, in a sort of supporting role or as a off the stage, even, that it's only kind of as an afterthought or totally secondary that they even are mentioned. Now here's an example, skipping ahead to page 115, as to the point of his whole description here of the crisis and his proposed solution. On page 115, again, Yaki being Yaki expresses things in these grand dichotomies, capitalized words, anthropomorphizing these spiritual or intellectual things. He writes, in complete contradiction to our instinct, feelings, and ideas, the 19th century sits leering upon the throne of Europe. I remember he's writing right after World War II in 1948. The conflict is far-reaching. It affects every sphere of life. And he capitalizes life. The two ideas are opposed. Not concepts or abstractions, but ideas, capitalized, which were in the blood of men before they were formulated by the minds of men. The resurgence of authority, and he capitalizes R and A there, stands opposed to the rule of money, capitalized R and M, order to social chaos, all capitalized, hierarchy to equality, socioeconomico-political stability to constant flux, glad assumption of duties to whining for rights, socialism to capitalism, ethically, economically, politically, the rebirth of religion to materialism, fertility to sterility. And keep in mind he's contrasting two sides of this conflict throughout here. The spirit of heroism to the spirit of trade, the principle of responsibility to parliamentarianism, the idea of polarity of man and woman to feminism, the idea of the individual task to the ideal of, quote-unquote happiness, discipline to propaganda compulsion, the higher unities of family, society, state, to social atomism, marriage to the communistic ideal of free love, economic self-sufficiency to senseless trade as an end in itself, the inner imperative to rationalism. Now, I was with him all along the way there until the very end, where he attributes everything, all of the negative sides of those comparisons, to rationalism. He obviously has it in for rationalism, as we saw in his discussion of liberalism. His view of liberalism was that it was bad because it was rationalism, mechanistic. But the greatest opposition of all has not yet been named. The conflict which will take up all the others into itself. This is the battle of the idea of the unity of the West against the nationalism of the 19th century. There are his 19th century outlook versus his 20th century idea of the unity of the West. Here stand opposed the ideas of empire and petty statism, large space thinking, and political provincialism. Here find themselves opposed the miserable collection of yesterday patriots and the custodians of the future. The yesterday nationalists are nothing but the puppets of the extra-European forces who conquer Europe by dividing it. To the enemies of Europe, there must be no rapprochement, no understanding, no union of the old units of Europe into a new unit capable of carrying on 20th century politics. Here, in using the term petty statism, Yaki echoes what is, or people today echo Yaki in calling it petty nationalism, Yaki himself might have used the phrase petty nationalism too, because that's what he's talking about here, is yesterday nationalists. He's talking about how Europe has been divided and has warred amongst itself, white civil war, both in World War I and in World War II, and many other smaller conflicts before and probably in the future. And he deplores that and would prefer to see unity. Now, some critics of Yaki, I understand, see Yaki as himself as a threat to Europe, as a threat to Europe because this idea of unification means to them a blotting out of all of the unique and separate independent histories and myths and heroes and cultural ways of these separate European peoples. But I don't feel that way, but I have difficulty saying that Yaki doesn't feel that way. I would be impressing my own views onto Yaki to read Yaki in that way. I think Yaki actually does see Europe as being this one homogeneous blend, if not now that is the goal, or that is the ideal. That is part of his idea. And that's why he quoted Napoleon at the beginning of his chapter on race, as saying that Napoleon's own idea, if he had succeeded, would have been to have all of Europe think of itself as one country where people moved around freely and felt comfortable everywhere. This is really the internationalist globalist ideal too, to erase the borders, not only within Europe, but just doing that as a first step to erasing the borders everywhere in the world, because they just get in the way. It's a different way of thinking though, and Yaki attacks that economic motivation for erasing borders. And he does very distinctly divide the world into Europe and not Europe. So in that sense, he's very different from and it's unfair to compare him to as if he's the same as globalists and internationalists. What he says about divide and conquer is true, that that is part of the problem for Europeans, but part of the problem has also been the infiltration of Jews into each of these individual countries. And the Jews have been successful not just in hiding themselves amongst whites, quote unquote, undifferentiated whites or whites, people who have been misled into thinking that all whites are the same. They've also been able to infiltrate Germany, and they've been able to infiltrate England, and they've been able to infiltrate France and pose as Frenchmen, as good as Frenchmen, as the best Frenchmen and Germans and Englishmen. So it's not a problem unique to whites, but there is a basis to that argument that by broadening ethnic identity, racial identity, you allow the Jews to use the opposite of divide and conquer, which is unite and conquer, centralize and conquer, pass and conquer, you could call it. Now here also I realize the problem that I mentioned in an earlier installment with Yaki's own anthropomorphism, this capitalization of concepts and intellectual, spiritual things as if, and treating them as if they have a will and a goal in mind, as if they have life, as if they are humans. That's what anthropomorphizing something means. It means imposing or projecting a human-like mind onto things that aren't human. I couldn't put my finger on it back then when he was discussing liberalism, and I saw him doing it with liberalism. But I see now that why, and that specifically why I think it's wrong, more specifically now in Yaki's case, because, you know, first of all, in general, it imagines that inanimate objects are thinking, that they are somehow equivalent to human beings, that collections of ideas have a life of their own and drive themselves rather than being driven by human beings. But in Yaki's case, he actually does it, I hate to say it, but in a dishonest way, to take the agency away from human beings, people who actually decide what to do in their lives and decide what to pursue. And he assigns that instead to the Western civilization and spiritual things. More examples of that, I think, are coming up here. You know, in a sense, this is to put my own labels on it, but it's memes versus genes here. And in Yonke's mind, the memes are all that really matters. It's the ideology and the spirit and this intangible stuff, the culture, the civilization. And it's not the people and their genes. That's materialism in his mind. And rather than seeing it as a blend of the two, even, he wants to only see it as the memes, the ideas, the intangible. Now, to flesh out this problem he has with petty statism and race, his views on race, he actually describes why he doesn't like Darwinism. And I should just jump right into it here rather than trying to introduce it. But it comes dangerously close to the contemporary anti-racist attitude about Darwinism and with the whole idea that race is a social construct or a cultural construct. And that there isn't any biological basis to it. On page 65, he writes, "The great foundations of the old outlook were rationalism and materialism. They will be completely examined in this work, but here it is proposed to treat only three thought systems, Darwinism, Marxism, Freudianism, products of materialistic thought, all of which were the focus of great spiritual energy in the 19th century, and which continued, continuing to have a vogue in the early 20th century, contributed greatly to lead Europe into its present abyss." So he breaks down the cause of the conflict between the 19th and 20th century, or highlights this conflict as being due to these three thought systems, Darwinism, Marxism, and Freudianism. Now, in identifying Marxism and Freudianism, I think he's correct, and those are both Jewish intellectual movements, as Kevin MacDonald has described in excruciating detail. Darwinism doesn't fit with those other two things, and I think in this, Yaki was very wrong to even consider the three of them, consider Darwinism to be one of those three, to be similar at all to Marxism and Freudianism. Marxism and Freudianism were frauds, and they were, I want to say patent frauds, but they weren't so obvious. Many intelligent people went along with them. But certainly now in retrospect, we can see that they were frauds. Marxism, the attempt to turn everything into a materialistic view, to reduce the relations between people to material and ultimately financial, monetary ways of seeing it, rather than race. And Freudianism being an attempt to psychopathologize Europeans, in a nutshell. Yaki writes, "The basic idea of Darwinism, quote-unquote evolution, is as little novel as the particular theories of the system. Evolution is the great central idea of the philosophy of the 19th century." So here he actually identifies Darwinism of the three as the central idea of the 19th century that he dislikes so much and sees in conflict with his idea of the 20th century and the future. Darwin's innovation wasn't evolution. It's misattributed to him. That's true. His innovation was to explain the mechanics of evolution. Similarly to how it wasn't Darwin that discovered DNA or genes, but later scientists who figured out that that was the mechanics of it. Darwin figured out that the mechanics of evolution, or proposed that the mechanics of evolution, was natural selection, the modification and mutation of living organisms, and then selection, which eliminated organisms which weren't fit. And just as a disclaimer here, I have to say that I'm not an expert in Darwinism, but I am somewhat familiar with the terminology and the concepts. So I will take up the other side of Yaki's criticism here and answer some of his criticism. It gets pretty bad, in a cringeworthy way. "Darwin's system has two aspects, of which only one is treated here, for only one was effective. This was Darwinism as a popular philosophy." He's wrong there. He's basically saying that, and the broader this context in which he's writing this makes this clearer. The science aspect of Darwinism is the most successful. That's not the one that he's going to talk about. Most successful in the sense that it has emerged over time victorious in all, against all challenges, against all skeptics, for what that's worth. That's how science works. People propose theories and other people try to shoot them down, try to devise experiments to validate or invalidate the theories, and it moves along that way. What Yawkey is aiming at here is the popular philosophy, and by that he means social Darwinism, what became called social Darwinism, what is associated with Henry Spencer, the man who actually popularized the term survival of the fittest, and who applied it not just to animals, but to human beings, who was an evolutionary scientist in the same sense that Darwin was, didn't invent evolution, but was working at about the same time. Scientific racism is what it's called today by anti-racists, who see basically the point that Yawkey's making, which is that it's Darwinism applied to human beings. And Yawkey thinks it's wrong to do that for reasons that sound very similar to what anti-racists have to say about it. Yawkey says, and this is where he's probably different from the anti-racists, he says, the system shows its provenance as a product of the age of criticism in its teleological assumptions. Evolution has purpose, the purpose of producing man, civilized man, English man, in the last analysis, Darwinians. It is anthropomorphic. The aim of evolution, quote unquote, is not to produce bacilli, but humanity. This actually is one of the same criticisms that anti-racists make, and I'm thinking specifically of Stephen Jay Gould made arguments like this in his arguments against the biological basis for race and against quote unquote scientific racism, was that it laid out this descent of man as if it was a tree ever progressing toward, as Yawkey describes it, toward producing man and then civilized man, English man, and finally Darwinians. That isn't really, I don't think, what Darwinism was about, and even social Darwinism may have smacked of that, but I don't think that that was what it was all about or relied on. It wasn't hinged on that. The ideas weren't hinged on that. The Englishmen and the English Darwinists who thought and wrote about Darwinism as applied to human beings no doubt had some bias, some bigotry, some chauvinism, some favoritism for themselves. They, to that extent, they weren't liberals. They were willing to take their own side. They were supremacists in the idea that they, their own group to which they belonged, they thought was the best. And they rationalized that supremacism in that way. Page 69, the system shows its provenance. Yeah, I read that already. Teleology is kind of an esoteric idea from philosophy, although you see it more and more outside of philosophical discussions. More and more non-philosophers are using it. It just means the idea that nature or something in nature inherently is tending towards some definite end, as if it's got agency, as if it's got causality. It's as if it has life. And here it's interesting to note that Yawkey is criticizing Darwinism for having teleological assumptions, for assuming that life evolves in a particular direction. It's a common criticism of Darwinism that anti-racists have made.